My guests tonight are the co-authors of the book that I mentioned in the pre-introduction, Holocaust, A History. Those guests are Deborah Dwork, who is professor of Holocaust history and director at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, of the Center for Holocaust Studies. And her co-author is Robert Jan van Pelt, who is professor of architecture and cultural history at the University of Waterloo in Canada. They are the co-authors of a book that appeared a few years ago and which we had the pleasure of discussing with Deborah Dwork at that time. It was a history of Auschwitz, titled Auschwitz 1270 to the Present. You find crucial sentences sometimes in a book which sort of give, which lay out the perspective as to what will be developed. And I found just such a sentence in the very first chapter, I think, of your book, and I want to read it to you and instantly get the two of you to respond to it. Quote, "The Europe that permitted the Holocaust was not created in 1933. It took centuries to descend so low, but descend Europe did." Deborah Dwork.
You are right, Milt. That sentence encapsulates exactly what we were aiming to do with this book. So often people talk about the Holocaust as a 12-year blackout period in the history of Western civilization.
A madman imposed himself on Germany and he sold them this bill of goods and he drove them in the direction of his own madness, which was a homicidal madness.
Exactly. An aberration in Western society, an aberration of Western civilization had nothing to do with what came before or what came after. And our view was, it's true it was a blackout period, but it was a blackout period with very long and very deep roots.
But a question rises instantly. I remember the title of an article, a seminal article by Milton Himmelfarb, which gives, the whole thesis is given in that article, No Hitler, No Holocaust.
Probably, if Hitler had not existed, the Holocaust would not have happened, certainly not in the form it did. But Hitler is only one part of the whole picture. He's only one cause out of many. People tend to forget that by 1919, for example, a major genocide of Jews took place in Ukraine. 500,000 Jews were killed there as a result of an anti-Semitic campaign, which was triggered at the time by white Russian officers, anti-communist officers who blamed the Jews at the time for the coming to power of the Reds. And under the kind of slogan of Judeo-Bolshevism, set out to kill every Jew they found. So we don't need Hitler simply to start to have a fantasy about a conspiracy of Jews and Bolsheviks to subjugate the earth. Of course, Hitler was central in getting Germany to become part of this act. At the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th and 20th century, one observer asked, you know, if there's going to ever to be a genocide of the Jews, where will this happen? And it was said at the time, most likely it's going to be in France, because France had gone through a terrible anti-Semitic wave with the Dreyfus Affair, and anti-Semitism had become very popular in France, and as the Germans would say, salon fair, had become socially acceptable, almost in a way it wasn't in Germany at the time. But Hitler was able to in some way gather those forces and in some way incorporate it in the German state and make it a state program of genocide.
One could fall back upon the simple logical device of discriminating necessary and sufficient cause. And your argument is that Hitler and Nazism and its rise may have been the sufficient cause for the ultimate Holocaust, but the necessary causes lie far further back in European history.
I do absolutely believe that. I think that there were necessary causes, and those necessary causes included anti-Semitism. Prior to that, traditional Christian anti-Judaism, and that is a distinction with a difference.
Let's clarify that distinction. Anti-Semitism versus or compared to anti-Judaism.
What we hold is that there certainly was traditional Christian anti-Judaism, that is, the church faulted the Jews for not accepting Jesus as the Messiah. And certainly for centuries, there was a history of the demonization of the Jew, this traditional Christian anti-Judaism. At the same time, the church recognized that the Jews had a covenant with God, the first covenant, and that covenant was valid. Therefore, as St. Augustine said, preserve the Jews, preserve them in misery, but preserve them. So at the very same time as there were these centuries of demonization of the Jews, there was another conversation going on, and that conversation was about coexistence, uneasy coexistence between Jews and Gentiles, unequal coexistence between Jews and Gentiles, but coexistence nevertheless. Much later, in the modern period, comes the development of the idea of race. And after this development of an idea of race came to the idea of annihilatory racist anti-Semitism.
But in your analysis, you also find in the middle of that process, and you point up the importance of the Crusades, the extinction or the campaign against the Albigensian heretics, and various other indulgences in slaughter
in
the name of
Christ,
in the name of Christianity.
Yeah, no, there's a kind of a paradox at work in Europe, let's say before the French Revolution, is that on one side the society is a deeply traditional society everywhere in Europe. And a traditional society is really defined by the idea that what you have inherited as a patrimony from your parents or from your father, it's a male chauvinistic society, is that what's worthy to be preserved. This is the way my father did it, this is the way I will do it. And so the church was a traditional organization, and the church had, at the beginning of its history, accepted the Jews as a part of God's salvation. And it had said that a Jew has a place, as Deborah said, but this place will be a place, basically a lesser place than that of the Christian. At the same time, however, there was another kind of force at work in the church, and that is that the church is an instrument, God's instrument of renewal, of change. The church will convert the peoples of this earth, and it will bring the gospel of Christ. And so this is a real tension which exists in the church for 1500 years, and maybe in some way it even exists today still, that at one side it wants to preserve the institution, that what it has been given in the past, the Gospels, for example, the tradition of the church fathers. At the same time, it's a force for renewal. And where the church is a force for renewal, in its crusades, for example, when it tries to convert the heathens, the Muslims and so on, it can be very violent.
You come up with the datum, the historical fact, I presume it's well authenticated, that in the First Crusade, the year 1096, among other things that they did as they marched around, was to kill about 10,000 Jews.
Yes, this is absolutely correct.
Is that the first major pogrom of the pre-modern variety under Christian auspices and leading to the extermination of a large number of Jews?
Yes, I mean, what the First Crusade did was in some way activate that force for change in the church. It changed the church from mainly a traditional organization into one which was traditional and at the same time also revolutionary.
And it's a change from grudging tolerance of these unpleasant people, the Jews, to really an exterminationist indulgence.
Yes. No, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say so. It was during the time of the Crusade for sure. But then the situation reverted mm-hmm. right back to this uneasy, unequal coexistence.
And that really remains the case up until the 19th century, I would suppose.
Yes, of course, there was the Second Crusade just 50 years later.
Yeah, but I mean, after the Crusade.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And there, of course, there were episodes of local violence, no doubt about it. But the mainline theology held, preserve the Jews, preserve them in misery.
Now where does this shift from theological disdain for the Jews give way to a kind of racialist disdain for the Jews? Certainly long before Hitler, we have people in the 19th century preaching racialism, the Jews as somehow a an evil biological presence in the European body, which must be exterminated, which must be expelled and somehow staunched and controlled. You have Houston Chamberlain writing in those terms. You have, who's the Frenchman?
Gobineau.
Gobineau, the Count de Gobineau. Mm-hmm. They're writing in those terms in the second half of the 19th century, are they not?
In some way, we can go even a little bit more back. I mean, there are really three steps to the kind of demonization of the Jew in a kind of modern anti-Semitic imagination. The first step is that the Jews are emancipated, which means that with the late 18th century, the French Revolution, then the establishment of more or less kind of modern nation states, the Jews are taken into the body politic of the nation. They're giving rights.
Napoleon thought he was doing us a favor.
Yeah. I mean, Napoleon said at
some
certain moment, you know,
afoot,
you will be Frenchmen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first thing is that the Jews become visible and they become competitors to people.
Yeah.
They are allowed now to become doctors, to become lawyers, to set up shops and to be in competition with the Gentile population. So that is the first big change, that the Jew become visible and the neighbor and they acquire a certain kind of competitive edge even. The second thing, I don't know if you want to address it tomorrow. The second thing is that what you get at a certain moment is this idea of race. Now, the original racist theory actually was not anti-Semitic. The Count de Gobineau, who invents racism in the mid-19th century as a reaction to what he sees, the terrible kind of convulsions of the French Revolution, is not an anti-Semite. But he does believe that the history of the world is a history of a conflict between superior and inferior races, and that the white race, which originally is called the Aryan race, coming from India, was a superior race, which in this new kind of almost globalized world of the 19th century was threatened with extinction.
As Richard Weaver said a long time ago in the title of his famous book, Ideas Have Consequences, is it possible that in this already we see the potency of the ideas derived from Darwin, the theory of, you know, the survival of the fittest and so on, and the necessary clash between opposed species?
I would say not yet.
It does contribute later
but
on.
But it certainly contributes, no doubt about it, it certainly contributes, because what Gobineau was so interested in was maintaining the supremacy of the white race. He thought that the white race was the superior, and he wanted to ensure that the white race would do its allotted duty to the world.
We're still looking at background, the necessary conditions rather than the sufficient ones. We want to come shortly to the Nazis, their rise, and how they went from their disdain for the Jews, their attempt to legally restrict them, how they went from that rather quickly to eliminationist, and then to ultimately exterminationist intention, successful exterminationist intention. But still, dealing with background and focusing in now on Germany, two figures come readily to mind as intellectual contributors, Wagner and Nietzsche. What do you make of them?
Well, I thought that you were going to go to Karl Marx.
Well, by all means, go there if you think he's relevant.
I think Karl Marx is very relevant.
He was a very anti-Semitic Jew, among other things.
A very anti-Semitic Jew, and also he was a proponent for social change.
Mm-hmm.
And this social change we normally think of in terms of economic change, and change of economic system. But it was Karl Marx who fused this idea of Jews as capitalists, and that if the capitalist system was going to be overturned, then the Jew also had to be overturned. Never mind the fact that, of course, very few Jews were capitalists, but this, we really have Karl Marx to thank for this strand of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and others picked that up much later. A German sociologist, sort of, Werner Zumbaut, develops that theme and writes really quite strong anti-Semitic economic theory.
Yeah, Helden und Händler. Yeah,
that's exactly.
About the. He creates a theory that history is really about heroes and merchants,
mm-hmm.
and of course that the Germans in some way. The adventurer, they are the expression of the hero, and the Jew is the archetypical kind of merchant who sells out. You know, that's of course the important thing about the merchant. But may I go back to Wagner, maybe?
Yes, since he is a crucially placed figure, isn't he?
And he's a very complex figure in this whole story, because Wagner was a revolutionary originally. I mean, he participated in the 1848 revolution in Germany, and lost out and was sent in exile. And in a state of utter rage against basically the forces that had destroyed this revolution, for which the hopes had been so high at the beginning, he tries to find someone to blame, and he finds the Jews to blame, and he basically, his argument develops at various parallel tracks. But basically the idea, what he says, is that the Jews have corrupted in some way the integrity of the Germans. And they've done that one way is by appropriating the art, the cultural production of the Germans. The idea is that the Germans are, they express themselves, they become themselves, they recognize themselves in the art they produce, especially music, of course, which is from Bach onwards and Mozart and Wagner himself sees as the supreme German art. And that in the mid-19th century, Jewish musicians, Jewish conductors, Jewish art critics in some way had appropriated that art and had alienated the Germans from their own soul.
He's particularly bothered by the popularity of Mendelssohn.
Yes. And Meyerbeer, of course.
And Meyerbeer.
And so he gets this obsession in his mind that in some way the Jew has robbed the German of the German soul, of his own soul. And that the Jew, of course, it's always talked about the Jew, not the Jews plural, but the Jews singular, as if this is one kind of organism, is in some way now corrupting the innermost essence of the German. That's the way he's talking about it. So then he gives analysis, for example, about the way Jews talk and how they're corrupting the German language. And so then his conclusion is the only way by which the German can be saved from this internal disintegration is if the Jew is going to be removed from German society. And this is then an idea which ultimately will be picked up by the Nazis.
Is that especially the first clear call in early modern German life for getting the Jews out of Germany?
Yes.
Is that the first programmatic statement?
I would say so.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I would disagree with maybe any programmatic statement because he doesn't actually create a program. I mean, he talks about it as a philosopher.
Yeah.
Programs.
But he points to it as a purpose which could be achieved.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
We are very late for commercials. That always happens when I've got a really good conversation going, so we must sort of stop in midstream. But after that, we need to go forward, of course, to Munich. And that sort of odd provincial from Austria who's knocking around the streets of Munich, leading demonstrations, and the beginnings of the Nazi Party. And their very quick ascent from the early 1920s to 1933, 34, and they are essentially a period of 10 years, and they are ruling Germany. And ultimately they are at the point of attempting to rule all of Europe at a very, very high cost to the human spirit and to human dignity
human
and
life.
Human life. We return to Dvorah Dvorak and Robert Jan van Pelt directly after these words. And we return to conversation with the authors of a very important and utterly readable but devastatingly pointed book, pointed towards our human capacity for evil. When one falls into easy mystical confusion about Nazism and the Holocaust, one says, well, here we see the ultimate evil nature of man, and it's always there just below the surface, and we have to worry about that, and that's the tragic dilemma in which we flounder. And that's probably true, but that kind of stops conversation and stops historical analysis. So I will eschew that for the moment. And we come back to the question of where the Nazis came from and how they did it and how they persuaded a country which, to be sure, had its own anti-Semitic history, but had not been as overtly anti-Semitic as France and possibly even England, for all we know. How they persuaded them, and certainly East Europe, the Slavic nations, and Russia, how the Germans were able to be, could be turned towards what they ultimately did. There's a play by Bertolt Brecht, which is now being revived in New York, Al Pacino playing the lead role, called The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy, who I gather, according to Robert Brustein's review, which I read just the other night, is modeled on Hitler, and it's intended to be a kind of metaphor for the rise of Adolf Hitler. Though Arturo Uli is a gang chief in the city of Chicago, as it happens. How do we explain the resistible rise of Adolf Hitler and his Nazi bunch?
Now, at least we explain it in our book as a result of the First World War. Without the First World War, it's very clear that Hitler would have been a nobody and the Nazi Party would not have existed. The First World War brought a few things together. The first of all is that in 1914, when this war broke out, there was this incredible sense of unification of a common kind of cause, which energized all Germans. They were excited about this war. Now, by December 1914, 4 or 5 months after they had started the fighting, it was clear that it was not going to be an easy victory. And at that time, a spirit developed in the trenches amongst the soldiers. And in some way, they were in some way like Christ being crucified, a kind of German Christ being crucified, that they were suffering on behalf of a greater principle. As they were some way telling themselves this story, that they were that there was a kind of great metaphysical process at work in their suffering, in this fight, that this was not an ordinary war, but a kind of almost like a cosmic war. At the same time, they started to in some way exclude the Jews, the German Jews, from this experience. They felt that they were in this kind of mystical bond in the trenches, that they were experiencing this ultimate test of what it means not to be a human being, but what it means to be a German. And the Jews couldn't be part of that. And so so there are two things happening simultaneously, and this is strengthened throughout the First World War. The first sense is that there is this incredible original and strong bond amongst Germans of German blood, and at the same time, those citizens of Germany who are not of a German racial background cannot be part of that. And this, in some way, is the basis from which National Socialism will develop.
Perhaps one of the most obvious examples of this is the so-called Jew count, when rumors went round and round that Jews were not serving proportionate to their numbers on the front. Now, finally, the War Office actually did do a Jew count and found that not only were Jews serving in proportion, they were serving beyond what they should have been doing, that there were a greater percentage of Jewish young men on the front than the norm. So, but they refused to publish those figures. So the War Office was not embarrassed about this. They weren't embarrassed about having done this Jew count at all. They weren't embarrassed about not revealing the figures. The anti-Semites, who kept saying that this was so, were not embarrassed. And the only people who shouldn't have been embarrassed, the Jews, they were deeply embarrassed by this experience. So in fact, World War I turned out to be an incredibly divisive experience for Gentile Germans and Jewish Germans.
But somebody had to be blamed, and the Nazis, by blaming the Jews for the general economic disorder in Germany and the general conflict between left and right, the Jews were then an easy and available target. And there was the whole long old European tradition lodged in Christian culture to begin with, which could be drawn upon.
But not only that, the Nazis actually blamed the Jews for military failure and for the crack in the home front. The German nation would have succeeded, they claimed. They would have been victorious.
Their line was the Jews gave us the stab in the back.
The stab in the back argument.
But let's look at that from the Nazi point of view. I mean, if you look simply at what the Nazis saw in 1919, you know, in some way, they made an argument which was understandable to the man in the street. That is, that Jews were not allowed in the German Empire before 1918 into ministerial posts. In the first government, the first post-defeatist defeat government of 1918, late 1918, of the six major ministerial figures, four were Jews. Then the next question which comes up is that there are a number of revolutions are taking place in 1918, 1919 in the various states in Germany, most importantly in Bavaria. A communist government is established in Bavaria and they have a Jewish prime minister, Mr. Eisner. Then the next step is that then the Versailles Treaty is proposed to the German public and to the German parliament, the Weimar parliament. And many Germans are against it, but it happens to be that the first people who are arguing in favor of accepting the terms imposed by the Allies happen to be a number of very prominent Jewish editors of the major Jewish newspapers. So it isn't so that we are only in a kind of fantasy world. Once you accept that this defeat ought not to have happened, once you accept that the Treaty of Versailles should not have been accepted, once you accept that social change should not occur, then in some way you can actually, on the ground of empirical evidence, say the Jews are guilty.
Still, isn't it the case that the anti-Jewish theme was common currency in German political life in the years after World War One? One still has to account for the rise of this one anti-Semitic band rather than various others. How did the Nazis go from Munich 1923-24 to Berlin 1934?
I would say that there are two major things. One has to do with what's happening in Germany with the Weimar Republic, and the second is what's happening with the Nazi Party. And so the first is, when you look at what's happening in Germany with the Weimar Republic, what I would say to you, Milt, is that Weimar Republic, it just couldn't catch a break.
Didn't work.
Well, it did at a certain point. It didn't. Many people say,
yeah.
The Weimar Republic was doomed to failure. It wasn't doomed to failure. It did very badly at the beginning. It had a lot of problems to overcome. But by 1926, it was doing okay. It was doing okay in terms of decreasing unemployment, or rather increasing employment rates, also doing much better in terms of trade, also doing much better in terms of standing of Germany in the international community. Things were doing okay for the Weimar Republic. But as I say, that poor Weimar Republic just couldn't catch a break. Comes the Depression, of course. The worldwide Depression had a huge effect on Germany. And also the rigidity of the Allies in their demands upon Germany, which prohibited Germany from developing other partnerships, for example, trade relationships with the Soviet Union, in the Soviet Union. So one, for one reason and another, some of those which could have been preventable, some of which were not preventable, for all of these reasons, there were such stresses and strains on the Weimar Republic that it did fail. It ultimately did fail. So that's one piece of it. But the other piece of it is Hitler. Because just because a country is in such terrible conditions doesn't mean that a party like the Nazi Party would come to power. And in this, I would like to point out the importance of Mussolini. I always thought of Arturo Uy as not as, in terms of Adolf Hitler, but Benito Mussolini. But I may very well be wrong, of course. But in any case, the importance of Mussolini as a model for Hitler. Hitler's political success, certainly in part, was due to the spectacular success of Mussolini, and very specifically, the tactics that Mussolini used. The strong arm tactics.
Thuggish tactics.
Sorry?
Thuggish tactics.
Thuggish tactics, but also mesmerizing the masses with
charismatic claims and style.
Charismatic claims in style, huge pageants, torch-lit processions, all kinds of things to make people feel that they were part of a whole nation that was on the move again, that wasn't stuck, wasn't stagnant, wasn't behind the times, but was going forward.
And so they did. And by 1934, they are in power. After a brief interregnum when Hitler, as the leader of the party, is appointed chancellor, I guess. Was that the official? And Hindenburg is still the president, but Hindenburg dies, and pretty quickly they just grab all the power.
Correct.
And then kind of reorganize the government, and it becomes essentially a Führerstaat. It becomes a state led by one man. Is it the case, I wonder if I got this right in German, that he used to say often in his speeches, all that I am through you. This is to the public. But all that you are only through me. Alles, was ich bin, bin ich nur durch euch. Aber alles, was ihr seid, sind sie nur durch mich.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean...
It's such a wonderful mystical formula. We are bound together, the mass
in the body.
And I. Yeah.
In some way, of course, I mean, Hitler was born as a Catholic, and he what you see in the Führer cult is basically a secular version of the idea of the embodiment in one person
indeed
of a whole
indeed
nation. In
yeah
Christ, the whole of the world is embodied. In Hitler, the whole of Germany is embodied. And so he will also say that, you know, in me Germany walks, you know, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, this is literally this embodiment of the nation.
And did Germany really buy it? Surely the sophisticated Junker generals and the leading industrialists of the Ruhr, they weren't swept up in that kind of mass enthusiasm, were
yeah,
they?
Yeah, but many of these people, of course, didn't buy this. But the problem was they were discredited. The depression, their failure ultimately to in some way realize the promise of the Weimar Republic by the late 20s, their failure to in some way save the Weimar Republic from 1929 onwards, when the Depression started, meant that they had no credibility. The people were hungering for new ideas, and the elites had been unable to give new ideas.
Again, we're, of course, late for commercials. The crucial question before us now is, well, they had power. We haven't given a full account of it. Your book does, and it does it wonderfully well. But this is merely a radio program. But they have power. They have risen on a platform opposing the Jews and saying the Jews, drawing from something, I guess, a line given by Treitschke around the turn of the century, the Jews are our
misfortune.
Die Juden sind unser Unglück. That was a slogan they would often put up on across the hall when they were having a big Nazi rally. So they're going to do something about their Jewish misfortune, and they began as soon as they were in power. But still, the rest of the world never expected that it would come. It would ultimately lead to the extermination of 6 million human beings. How that happened, how they went from there to the ultimate, is what we need to account. And we will return to that basic question with Robert Jan van Pelt and Deborah Dvorak, authors of Holocaust, A History, which book is just recently published by Norton. But first, these words. We are drawing from, but cannot possibly do full justice to, a very important and yet an utterly readable new book titled Holocaust, A History. Its authors, Deborah Dvorak and Robert Jan van Pelt, are my guests. Deborah Dvorak is the professor of Holocaust history and director of the Center for Holocaust Studies at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Robert Jan van Pelt is professor of architecture and cultural history at the University of Waterloo in Canada. And they were the authors about 5 or 6 years ago of an earlier book, which was a full history of Auschwitz. Auschwitz, 1270 to the present, a masterly work which I found of great interest. Indeed, I had the pleasure of reviewing it for some national publication. We come then to the Nazis in power. We haven't fully accounted for their rise, but we did what we could. It's a very complex and a very fascinating story. But they are in power, and they've got the anti-Semitic program that they have enunciated in their rise to power. How soon do they go after the Jews, and in what way do they do so?
They come to power. Hitler becomes chancellor in the end of January 1933. He organizes elections, and he is elected in March 1933, establishes a new government by the 20th. And 10 days later, the first major Jewish action begins, which is a boycott against the German Jews. organized very much as a response to pressure from below. Suddenly, all these little Nazis, they feel that now their party is on top, that they have been marginalized in this traditional society in some way for 10, 15 years, and now they want everything. And in some way, they see that their Jewish neighbor is going to be the key to getting everything immediately. And so they start agitating for an immediate action against Jews. And the government responds to that by declaring this boycott, and which then starts on the 1st of April.
But is the ultimate extermination already in view? One remembers Hitler quite early on in Mein Kampf says, we've really got to get rid of the Jews. We've got to get them out of Germany. One remembers that their marching songs, the Horst Wessel Lied, has in it the line that things will really be great when Jewish blood flows from the knife. Then Judenblut von Messerspritz, isn't that?
That is true.
So there's the killing, there's the implication that we're going to ultimately kill these people is already somehow in the air, is it not?
But a language of violence is not necessarily an action of violence. And it is absolutely true that Hitler never swerved from his anti-Semitic course. Before I was speaking about the ways in which Hitler modeled himself after Mussolini, there was a huge difference. Mussolini was a fascist, and anti-Semitism was not a part.
Mussolini had one or two Jews on the fascist Grand Council at one point.
Absolutely, and many more who were members of the fascist party.
And his ultimate sponsor was a Jewish woman.
Yeah, yes, absolutely, that's true. Nazism did not embrace anti-Semitism until much later, until 1938. Fascism didn't embrace anti-Semitism until much later, until 1938, when Mussolini had become the junior partner to Hitler. But going back to Hitler now, Nazism always held anti-Semitism close to its core. But to hold anti-Semitism close to its core does not mean that it's annihilatory anti-Semitism. So the first moves are to throw the Jews out of the body politic, to ostracize Jews socially, and to disenfranchise them.
And take away all professional life.
And to take off all economic opportunity.
Yeah.
So in all of these ways, the idea was to marginalize Jews.
And all of this pushed a lot of Jews out of Germany, didn't it?
It absolutely did, and that was on purpose.
Yeah.
What the Germans hoped was that the Jews would indeed emigrate.
Leaving their fortunes such as they were behind them.
Oh, yes.
They were required.
They were required
to pay their
that.
Way out, to pay
yes.
ransom.
Yes, to pay ransom to get out. Yeah. So it's a kind of double-edged sword. On the one hand, the Germans were desperate for, the Nazi Germans were desperate for Jewish Germans to leave. On the other hand, they were equally desperate for them to, for their fortunes. So greed is a huge part of this story.
But the war comes. We're jumping forward, and we can't really account for, we know that the Nazis invaded and took over all sorts of other things. They militarized the Rhineland. They took Austria rather easily against the protests of France and England. But Hitler...
But not against the protests of the Austrian people.
No, the Austrian people welcomed them, of course.
Oh, yes.
And, but
wildly.
Then they took the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia, the German area of Czechoslovakia, and 6 months later took all of Czechoslovakia. And Britain had a little concern about that, but Chamberlain yielded. And so we're on the brink of the war, the invasion of Poland, when finally in September 39, the war officially begins, though we're not yet in it. But
the United States is not yet
Germany,
in it.
But France and England are. And Hitler is rolling, his tanks are rolling into Poland. Do the exterminations begin that early?
Yeah, there are killings, but at that moment the Germans are killing Poles, the Polish elites, and they're killing some Jews. But at that moment still, the Germans have not yet formulated a program of systematic genocide. Jews get killed, like other people get killed, but at this moment the Germans are thinking of a mass deportation of the Jews. They don't know yet where. Now, again, I think it's important to look at, to understand how the Germans basically see the world at that moment, because they are in some way making policy, is to reconstruct basically the situation from their perspective, at least for a moment. 1933, they have some 560,000 Jews in Germany. They start creating a policy of harassment, of economic disenfranchisement, political disenfranchisement, and they start pushing the Jews out from 33 onwards. So they see that as the Jewish population in Germany diminishes, that in some way they have a successful policy. They are de-Judaizing Germany. Then they occupy Austria, and suddenly they have a couple of hundred thousand more Jews. So the whole policy of 4 years of anti-Jewish policy is by this occupation of Austria has been nullified. Then they start pushing the Jews of Austria out, and Mr. Eichmann is very active in that. Then they occupy the Czech lands. And again, they inherit a large Jewish population. Then they try to start to push the Czech Jews out, and it's very difficult by that time. It's 1939, and no country allows the Jews in. The next thing the Germans do is they conquer Poland, and they have 2.2 million extra Jews. So by the end of 1939...
The largest concentration of Jews in the world,
yes,
is in the old Pale of Settlement,
yeah,
which is Poland and the Ukraine and so on.
And so now suddenly the Germans see that their whole policy of pushing Jews out of the German sphere of influence has completely failed because of the success of the Wehrmacht. And so now the question is, what are they going to do? And so what originally is seen as a local German solution, which then became a German plus Austrian solution, now becomes a Central European solution.
Now we come to one of the great historical arguments, of course, the argument between the group that have sometimes been called the functionalists and the groups that have been called the intentionalists, historians of two different schools. The functionalists say it wasn't the intention of the Nazi hierarchy to exterminate all the Jews. That was a goal that eventually became more and more clear to them. And even so, it was improvised for much of the time, but it happened. It happened in part in response to the exigencies of the war itself. Whereas the intentionalists say, no, no, Hitler had that in mind from early in the 1920s. The Nazi hierarchy shared that exterminationist intention, but it took a while before they could pull it off. Who's right, who's wrong in that debate? It became, didn't they call this the historian's crisis, the historischer Streit, which is really the struggle of the historians in Germany? That is, in more recent years, it became issue, didn't it?
Thank you for putting us up in a situation of judging our very senior colleagues in the historical strike.
Yeah.
Streit. In our book, Deborah and I very clearly come down on a more functionalist kind of approach.
Yeah.
That is that, you know, if basically you go from 0 to 100, 0 is a total functionalist and 100 is a total intentionalist.
Well, we will follow your development of the functionalist interpretation more fully. Right now we pause for the usual reasons, and then we will return. And back to Deborah Dwork and to Robert Jan van Pelt, the co-authors of the very important and extremely informative and richly textured historical work, Holocaust, A History, that just published by Norton. Deborah, do I have it right about the intentionalist versus the functionalist in my overview and quick description of what their separate themes were?
Yes, you do have it right. I would say that American historians are not exercised by this debate any longer. Most people have come to some kind of common ground, which is that the Germans absolutely always did have, or rather the Nazi Party absolutely had the intention of getting rid of the Jews, but that doesn't mean necessarily that they meant to murder them. Now, Robert Jan was showing the world from the Nazi point of view a minute ago, and I would like us to step back a little bit farther just for a moment and to think about how it is that people come to murder other human beings, and to point out that millions of people were not born to be mass murderers. They became mass murderers step by step, and each step that they took changed the situation in which they were operating, but it also changed them and made them better prepared to take the next step. So that's another way of looking at the very same history that Robert Jahn was sketching a moment ago.
Yes, like the one of the things you see is that I'm going back now to the Germans, because they're in this case the agents. That at the beginning they think we need to do something with the Jews of Germany. Then they say that we need to do something with the Jews of Central Europe. And then at a certain moment they start attacking Russia. They say we need to do something with the Jews of Central Europe and Eastern Europe. And then they say at a certain moment we need to do something about all of the European Jews. And then the next step they say we need to do something with all of the Jews.
At Wannsee, when they run down that list, at the Wannsee conference run by Heydrich, that's in January 42, thereabouts, the list of the Jews that ultimately they have targeted includes the Jews of America.
Yes, they gave a long list of Jews, and indeed now it has become finally a total, what they call a Gesamtlösung der Judenfrage, a total solution of the Jewish question. But again, as De Boer just pointed out, this was a result of a number of steps, which were in some way reflecting the increase of power the Germans had, because more and more Jews had come.
But you know, I learned from this book of yours and from your previous book, The History of Auschwitz, that if you focus on Himmler a bit, Himmler and Heydrich, the top guys in the SS, and Himmler grabbed control of the whole extermination program. He was interested in extermination not merely to get rid of the Jews, who are our misfortune, but to clear the area so as to truly make living space for German emigration, and establish a greater Germany reaching all the way into the Ukraine. For this, you had to kill the Jews to kind of clear the area and make it essentially part of larger Germany.
I think that one of the central themes of our book is the role of so-called cleansing ideologies. Mm-hmm. And we have seen much of that in the 20th century.
They used the term. Their goal was to make Europe Judenrein, clean of Jews.
Absolutely. We have heard it in recent years. We talk about ethnic cleansing.
Indeed.
It's not cleansing at all. It's just plain murder. And so it was also in the Nazi time. But my point here is, and our point in this book, is the way in which people embraced a so-called cleansing ideology, which had a very dark underside, a murderous underside.
Well, your point is a psychological when you come to it step by step. Each step you take is something you can't reverse, and so you kind of lose your sensitivity and you take the next step, and after a while you become habituated to treating people badly, to whacking them around, and ultimately you go the next step when ordered and you shoot somebody into a pit, having tasted your first blood, it's easier to go on
and more
to the next step and to the larger step.
And more, Milt, because the reason why you're doing it is not for the pleasure of murdering Jews, but because you are engaged in a great struggle, because mm-hmm. you are engaged in a purifying struggle, because you are engaged in creating a heaven on earth, a physically perfect, genetically German society.
Here's something you know well. This is Himmler in his famous speech at Posen
mm-hmm.
to the SS hierarchy, in which he's telling them what great men they've been in seeing this through and killing, by that time, millions of Jews. And he says, "The hard decision had to be taken. This people must disappear from the face of the earth. For the organization which had to carry out this order," he means the SS, "it was the toughest of all the assignments it had ever had. It was carried out, I think I can say, without our men and our leaders suffering any damage to their spirit and their soul. The road between the two possibilities, either to become brutal and heartless and cease to have any regard for human life, or to become soft, to lose one's mental balance, and to end in nervous breakdown, the road between these Scylla and Charybdis is terribly narrow." And he goes on to say, but we've come through.
And he congratulates his men on having managed to...
And yet he says this is a chapter in our history that will remain forever unknown.
Yes, yes, an unwritten chapter
of glory.
They're
the great heroes, and you won't even be celebrated.
Yes, you won't be celebrated. And he's saying, the reason why you killed those Jews, the reason why it's so glorious, is not simply because you killed those Jews. The reason why it's glorious is because you have done this to make Germany pure and also to save Europe.
To preserve and restore the race, and by doing that, we are also restoring Europe to a
yes.
kind of a renewed higher civilization.
Exactly.
Without the Jews.
Exactly.
But a great question needs to be addressed. Yes, the SS saw that and bought it and did the killing. But what about the German army generally? What about the Wehrmacht? It used to be the running myth that the Nazis did it, the SS did it, but that the German generals kept their distance from it. German ordinary army units had no such role in the exterminations. But the evidence has been coming in more and more
clearly that
they
have. And now we know it's nonsense. Yes.
Do we know that it's absolute nonsense?
Now, certainly, if you look at Western Europe, the German army, the occupation in Western Europe in general, of course, first of all, Jews weren't killed in Western Europe. The Jews were taken from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, and there they were killed. So the people who were stationed in Western Europe, they probably can still get away with that story. But it's very clear that in Eastern Europe, the army was very much involved. There are stories, a lot of stories about the army witnessing the killings of Jews in Russia, mm-hmm. or the army being very active. For example, in Serbia, occupied Serbia, there was a policy in which Jews were taken hostage, and that for every soldier who was killed, 200 Jews would be killed. So the myth of the innocence of the German army has been thoroughly destroyed.
When they were doing that in Serbia, one of their intelligence officers was a man named Waldheim, if I remember correctly.
Yes, and this man
later the Secretary General of the UN.
Yes, yes, and he still, I still think that he gets a pension from the UN, but I'm not absolutely certain about
and
that.
And from Austria, whose president he
yes.
later became.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, but of course, Austria, they were all innocent. They were
now, you have those Einsatzkommando units before the death camps are fully established, who are ranging around, the four of them, I think, from north to south, five of them, and they are, how many people do they dispatch in their extermination program?
These Einsatzgruppen were kind of paramilitary units of policemen and SS-men, were a couple of hundred of people. Who basically would move from village to village in occupied Russia and organize killings. And they were kind of stealth operation, sometimes using local populations, local anti-Semites, especially in the case of Lithuania, sometimes working completely by themselves. And literally they would go into a village and basically round up all the Jews and kill them somewhere outside of the village.
The typical method was to first march the Jews out into the forest area, have the Jews dig a great big pit, get them into the pit, and then shoot them down, and then march in, throw some lime over them, and march in the next batch of Jews and get them into the same pit or dig a new pit. And on that basis, you might dispatch 5,000 a day if you worked
yes.
efficiently.
Yeah, and they were reporting on that. Every week a report would go back to Berlin to where they reported.
And we have those documents.
Those documents exist. And these are very detailed documents. Literally every person who's executed is accounted for. And these are shocking documents, because you see in the beginning, in the beginning of the summer of 1941, when the assault on Russia begins, you see that they, in generally talk about, you know, so many Russians have been taken and so many Jewish men. But you see that after a month or so, they start also to kill Jews. Women and then Jewish children, and by August 1941, you see that an Einsatzgruppe will kill 4,000 or 5,000 Jewish men, women, and children, and sometimes the majority of the people they're killing is children, and you realize this is not anymore part of an anti-partisan war. This is pure genocide.
And a significant change or a significant juncture occurs someplace in there. I'm not sure when. It isn't on any single day, but it's in a certain period of time when they decide this is not the efficient way to do it, and it's taxing our men in the Einsatzgruppen with too much burden. We've got to do it a different and a more efficient way, and that's the beginning of the death camps.
Yes, absolutely. The idea was that there had to be a way of separating the murder from the men. So the real problem was not to put distance. The real problem was not for the men, was not killing these people. The real problem was spattering blood and brains. They could not, this was demoralizing. Not the fact that the people were actually dead, but the mechanism by which. And so the Nazi hierarchy decided that they had to think of a better way to do exactly what you say, Milt, to put distance.
But they had a model going way back to their extermination before the war of mentally defective Germans. What was the name of that program?
T4 program, named after the address, Tiergartenstrasse, number 4. And that was the headquarters, that was the address of the headquarters for this program to murder those who were physically or mentally imperfect.
And they dispatched a few thousand.
Oh,
how many? 50,000.
Between 70,000 and 75,000
Germans.
Germans were German Gentiles and German Jews were murdered under the auspices of this program while it was still out in the open, quote unquote, legal. Hmm. At a certain point, the program went underground, became clandestine. It never stopped. It continued in a minor way throughout the war.
And the basic method was gassing, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
So there's the model for what they're now going to do in the camps.
That's exactly right. And about one quarter of the personnel from the T4 program were dispatched to the east to help the SS in that area set up gas chambers.
Huss, the commandant at Auschwitz, is one of them, is he not?
No. Auschwitz is the exception to that. I mean, it's not connected to the T4 program. The Wirt, who runs Belzec, one of the extermination camps in the east, and the people who run Sobibor and Treblinka, Stangl, they all come from the T4 program.
Oh, Fritz.
But Auschwitz, yeah, but
Fritz
Auschwitz
Stangl,
is separate.
Yeah. He's the one who was, about whom there's a wonderful early book by
Get to Sereni. Yes. Into that darkness.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's where they got their training. And for the SS, of course, to create these stationary, what we call stationary gassing installations, was a very convenient way to operate the killing, because once you basically put a gas chamber in a concentration or in a camp surrounded by barbed wire, you in fact can just withdraw your people. You're the SS men. You just have them guard basically the camp and terrorize the inmate population, which can be Jews, or you can have Ukrainian guards also be involved, but you can take a distance to it. And so that the really nasty bits of the operation will be done by slave workers.
A question left over, and it's one that has agitated many and about which various authors have expressed strong opinions, whether they've got equally strong evidence or not, is was the general German public back home aware of what was going on? To quote the title of Daniel Goldhagen's first major book, were the people in uniform Hitler's willing executioners, and were they backed by quasi-executioners or sympathetic executioners back home who thought this was a good thing and were all for it based upon the letters they were getting from Hans or Joachim on the front, who was recounting the killing of Jews. We have commercials overdue. Let's address that basic question. What is the responsibility, or what was the responsibility, of the general German public during those years? We return to Jan van Pelt, to Robert Jan van Pelt, and to Deborah Dwork after this. Now, we do want to get to the phones by 10:30. Therefore, we're opening the lines right now. The number, of course, is 591-7200. If you want to pose a question, offer a thought, by all means, get in touch and do it quickly. 591-7200. What about the general guilt of the German nation in this matter?
What Deborah and I argue in our book is that in some way the regime made a deal with the population. And the deal was, if you don't ask any tough questions, we're not going to tell you what we do.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell, exactly. So, and that worked until 1944, What happened in 1944 was that the German economy needed Jewish slave labor. And so the Germans had been pushing the Jews out and pushing even out of the concentration camp system. But in 1944, all these factories needed Jewish slave labor, and Jews were back introduced back into Germany as concentration camp slave laborers with big Jewish stars on the concentration camp uniforms and worked in the German economy as slave labor. And from that moment onwards, virtually every German could see what, in some way, the final solution meant.
And did any Germans overtly express regret, concern?
Absolutely not. The government was worried about what the reaction of the public would be, and there was even discussion about it, about those concerns, their trepidations. But they had no need for concern. There was no unrest.
Many issues are left over. Another one is raised by, it was raised in a conversation we had only the other night with Michael Beschloss, who's done a new book about Hitler, rather about Roosevelt and Truman in World War II. Here's a brief excerpt. I want you to hear this and then respond to it.
This question that I also deal with, the possibility of bombing Auschwitz in 1944, mm-hmm. you think what might have happened? And that's, you know, very subject to alternative history, because I should probably have a word on what that was. Spring of 1944, a lot of Jewish leaders were coming to the Roosevelt White House and saying, we Americans should bomb these death camps. It'll kill the inmates, but at least we'll stop this machinery of death to keep Hitler from killing Jews. And they also went to the Brits. And Churchill was sympathetic. Churchill said, I know that Hitler is committing the worst crime in human history, and let's do something about it. He asked his Air Force if they could bomb the death camps and the rail lines. They said the Americans are the ones in a position to do it. Until this book that I've just written, the thought was that the decision not to bomb Auschwitz only went up to a guy named John McCloy, the Assistant Secretary of War, who turned it down. It turned out, I discovered an interview that had not been seen that McCloy did at the end of his life, about 3 years before the end of his life, in which he said, no, actually, I took the question to Franklin Roosevelt. I said, do you want to bomb Auschwitz and these other death camps? He said the president turned down the idea flat. He said, we don't want
to. We cut because I want to come quickly back to it. And Beschloss does go on as well to argue that Roosevelt resisted the landing of any refugees on various ships who might have got into this country and was very resistant to the notion of having a welcoming American presence for large numbers of European Jewish refugees.
There are two forces at play. The first is a basic anti-Semitism, certainly in the State Department.
Felt by the President of the United States?
In part, but certainly in the State Department, and also, I think, at a very low level, at some kind of residual level, also by Franklin Roosevelt. Yes, I do. But there's something else, and that was that we were at war. And when we, one of the problems about talking about the Holocaust for us now is that the Holocaust looms large and World War II recedes into the distance. But in 1944, in 1942, 3, 4, and the beginning of 45, our country was seriously engaged in war. So Roosevelt also had the policy, which he shared with Churchill and Stalin, and that was salvation through victory. That is, the only way that the Jews were going to be saved was when the Allies would be victorious, and nothing, nothing whatsoever could be done which would deflect any part of military purpose from that goal. Now, we may think that that is very blinkered view. And I do think with the judgment of history that it was blinkered, that it could have been an and not such a strict either or. But that's not the way they saw it then. And I think that we need to put ourselves back into that psyche of a nation at war.
A leftover question, perhaps the last one before we stop for some commercials and then get onto the phones. I repeat again, the number is 591-7200. Some lines are taken, some are still available. If you want to join us, you should be calling instantly. Leftover question is, you get this again from Goldhagen's book, which was very controversial, that sort of the blame is with the Germans. There's something special about the Germans which enables them to do this kind of massive extermination, to do this genocidal crime, but it couldn't really happen elsewhere in the same way. Yet we do have increasing evidence, don't we, or we had that evidence for a long time, that many other European nationalities were involved in these exterminations.
Yes, I mean, already in the 30s, when the Germans started expelling their Jews, the politicians in the West say, you know, what the Germans are doing is maybe bad, but it would be much worse what's going to happen in Poland or Romania. These are the real anti-Semites. That's our big Jewish populations. We really fear for what can happen there. And indeed, in 1941, you see that the Romanians launch in June 1941 massacres of Jews, or genocide of Jews, more or less on their own initiative, and that the Romanian army starts killing Jews en masse before actually the German Einsatzgruppen do it. So that in that sense, the Romanians didn't have to learn anything from the Germans, and so that instead of saying this is one process which is only steered from Berlin, and that the Germans are the only, we need to look at the Germans to have an explanation of the Holocaust, we have to look at many other centers like Bucharest, like Budapest, and so on.
And you've also mentioned, earlier you mentioned Lithuania, you mentioned Ukrainians. They are present in the bureaucratic structure, and the administrative structure in the camps of the extermination program, aren't they?
Yes, yes, they are. But then they are under German leadership.
Yeah.
And what I think is so important is that the first act, and if you think of the Holocaust as a tragedy, the first act was in fact unfurled by the Romanians, not by the Germans. So the idea that Germans have a corner on the mass murder market, that idea is nonsense.
The great question, which we don't have time really to discuss, and it is 10:30 and I should be stopping in an instant, but the great question is, what has been learned? And another variant of that is, they say never again. Could it in fact happen again? It has happened elsewhere in the world again, has it not?
It absolutely has happened again, not in the same way, not to the same extent, but certainly we have seen many mass murders and genocides in the second half of the 20th
century. Just think of Cambodia, think of Rwanda, even more recently.
Yes. Nevertheless, I do think that we have learned some things. I do think that we have learned something about the nature of racism. I do think that we have learned about what happens if mass murders or genocides are not contained. And so, for instance, in the former Yugoslavia, when photographs of forced refugees on these trains, when those photographs were published on the front page of the New York Times and other newspapers throughout the Western world, there was an outcry precisely because of its historical antecedents.
With that, a necessary pause, and then right on to the phones. At the moment, all the lines are taken. If you're trying to reach us, you're not getting through. But do try again, particularly after we say goodnight to some prior caller. We return directly and on to your calls after this. And directly back to our conversation with Deborah Dwork and Robert Jan van Pelt, the co-authors of the very important new book, Holocaust, A History. Norton, the publishers, we go directly to the phones. Here is the first caller. Good evening.
Yes, Milt, I've got two questions for your guests. The first is that they were talking about a tension in Christianity on the regarding to the Jews. In about 1890, in the historical Jesus movement, Adolf Harnack and others were challenging the idea that early Christianity accepted the Old Testament and Jewish roots, and I was wondering if they have any opinion on if that sort of was an unintended consequence to help destabilize that tension.
Robert?
Hi. Now, I am no specialist on this specific issue, but throughout church history, there has been a tendency, there have been groups which call themselves, you know, Gnostics and so on, which have tried to deny the relevance of the Old Testament to the Christian gospel. And what you see is that in those movements, the anti-Judaism was always very strong, that, you know, if we don't need the Old Testament, then we don't need the Jews. And that much of the church history really has been a struggle against that, that the hierarchy, the bishops and so on, have always fought this particular kind of tendency of radical groups in Christianity, and that as part of this struggle against Gnosticism and this attempt to in some way separate the Old and the New Testament, they were also forced in some way to again reaffirm the value of Jews within the Christian tradition. And so this is ultimately where Augustine also comes to his particular vision of the place of the Jews in the Christian in a Christian world.
Yeah, the reason I was asking was Adolf Harnack was at the time the most famous church historian in Europe, so he wasn't one of the flake fringe. My other question is that the Nazis, in terms of just killing civilians, not for military operations, killed 12 million people, and just not the 6 million Jews, and they would have killed many more if the war hadn't stopped them.
Yes, and that's very interesting. Let me move rather quickly on that, sir, because time is short, but that, you raise a very interesting point there. The habit of killing groups that were sort of in the way or that were degraded and viewed as untermenschen, the Nazis felt rather free to kill Soviet soldiers.
Milt, you are right, and sir, you are correct. Slavs were just one step above Jews, and it is absolutely clear.
And they had to be thinned out also.
Oh, they absolutely did. 10% of Christian Poles were murdered by the Germans during the war. Now, in ancient times, we called that decimate. That nation was literally decimated. And had the Germans been victorious, and had they had time, they certainly would have killed many, many more. So you are absolutely correct that that 12 million civilians can be laid to their door.
Quickly to another caller, 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
And just before the break, you were discussing the question of whether or not Roosevelt and Churchill and the Allies could have done more to attack the rail lines going into the camps and to attempt to liberate the camps. And I'm not sure what the answer is on this question, but I thought I might cite a specific example. My late uncle was a navigator on a B-24 bomber, and he and all of his crewmates were killed on their very last training mission before leaving for Europe. And if memory serves me right, I've read that the overall casualties of the U.S. heavy bomber forces in Europe, killed, missing, wounded, and captured, were 33%. And that, of course, didn't count those who died ferrying their bombers across the Atlantic and those who died in training. So with the air effort being so ruinously expensive in terms of training time, which is generally a year, and money and lives and machines, it would seem that any effort that wasn't directed at reducing the Nazis' capability to make war would have been a waste of human and physical resources. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
I think that certainly when you look at the choices available to a military officer in the Air Force, that at that moment, that this how such a person would have looked at the various issues which were at play. The other thing was simply that studies have been made on this, that Auschwitz, that Auschwitz was for most of the early summer of 1944, which was when killings were at its highest, was out of range really of Allied bombers. It was really only when most of Italy was conquered that they came within range. And the third thing is that that in order to effectively bomb the rail lines, you need really kind of precision dive bombers, and that a kind of long distance heavy bombers. We know that from the way they bombed German cities, that they were very good at hitting a target at least within a 10-mile radius, but not any closer. So I think that ultimately the kind of debates which went on, that it was really not a very good way to tackle the problem, would have made sense to people at the time, even if we nowadays maybe would disagree with them. But it was a rational argument.
We thank the caller for an interesting contribution. I should say that now we've got a few lines available, and if you've been trying to reach us, you may well get through if you try again quickly, 591-7200. Of course, also, The email is available for particularly for our internet listeners in other countries or at some distance on either coast. And you reach us by email at extension 720, one word, at tribune.com. Extension 720 at tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E.com. 591-7200, the phone number. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Mel. My comment is about the non-Nazi German regular people, for lack of a better description, who are, you know, being cast in the shadow of blame for the camps as well by maybe not doing anything. But it's like the movie, like The Gray Zone right now, where it talks about some of the Jews in the camp who were forced to participate in this. I think there's an analogous situation with the people in the cities that if they would have come out and said anything, they would have been shot.
I don't agree with you. I think that Jews in the camps, and The Gray Zone comes from a chapter in Primo Levi's book, and Primo Levi, the Italian, the brilliant Italian novelist who was an inmate of Auschwitz, focused on this problem of choiceless choices, to use a term that Larry Langer has introduced, choiceless choices that Jews were forced to make by the situation. I don't agree that Gentile Germans were in the same situation in their homes and in Germany as Jews were. The power situation was very different. For instance, perhaps you don't know that German men, did not have to participate in the face-to-face killing of Jews. Any man who did not want to shoot could stand out, and he was not punished.
That's made very clear in Christopher Browning's study of the Ordnungsbataillon 101.
Ordinary men.
Is the title of the book.
You're absolutely
we thank
right.
you, sir, for the call. We must go rather quickly. I think right now we must pause, as a matter of fact, for our last round of commercials, and then back to your calls on 591-7200. And quickly back to the phones, here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. My call pertains to the controversy about the relationship between the Christian Church and the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
A little over a week ago, Mr. Goldhagen was on, and of course he has this new book charging that the role of the Catholic Church in particular was very great.
You may have heard me argue with him just a bit, saying you can't just specify the Catholic Church. You're talking about Christianity. If any particular institution is guilty of laying down an anti-Judaic orientation historically, it is Christianity. To begin with, Christianity was the Catholic Church, but when it branched out, certainly in the case of Luther, who was extremely anti-Semitic and writes a whole book to that effect, it's just a general endemic thing in European Christianity some while ago.
On the other hand, you've had the likes, as came up the other night with Mr. Goldhagen, that you've had First Things folks in there arguing, and I've heard this from Newhouse himself, to the effect that it was the unbelief of the Nazis that produced the Holocaust. So I'd be interested in the comments of your guests on all of that.
Well, we that's an invitation to say more about the role of the modern Christian churches in the time of the Holocaust.
I would like to answer that very quickly and talk about the role of the Pope, because what the bottom line here is the failure of the Pope. He failed the millions of Catholics who were looking to him for spiritual guidance as to what to do, and he remained silent. And he failed millions of Jews who looked to him as an extremely important, essentially important, spiritual leader in the Western world. And he did not extend his hand to them. And then I say, at the same time, thank God for the thousands of priests and prelates and nuns, that's in the Catholic Church and in the Protestant churches, the ministers and the clergy and the lay leaders within, the religious lay leaders, who did extend themselves to help Jews, who followed their own conscience and did not wait from word from on high, because had they waited for word from their bishops or from the Pope, none would have come.
Sir, we thank you for the call. I must interpose a question, but we'll get back to the phones in just an instant. What is the whole... It's a terribly simple question, but simple to state, but impossible to answer, particularly in short order. What has the Holocaust done to the Jews, to the surviving Jews, and to the Jews down to this time?
For one thing, the Holocaust, I think, posed an enormous question mark as to existence. So there was always a Zionist movement. The Zionist movement did not start with the Holocaust. But what the Holocaust seemed to do was to prove Theodor Herzl correct, to prove what he had claimed, which was that there was no safe place for Jews in Europe. And the Holocaust proved that to be correct. So if nothing else, what the Holocaust did for Jews is that it fueled their wish to have a safe harbor, to have a safe home.
A colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, Peter Novick, has done a book in which he analyzes the Holocaust industry, so to speak, or the Holocaust vogue. Similarly, another fellow with some scholarly credentials, Finkelstein, has written a nastier book in which he really condemns just about all Jews who take the Holocaust seriously, even though his own parents, apparently, died in the Holocaust. What are we to make about the tremendous elaboration and expansion of Holocaust activity, including Holocaust study centers like yours?
You know, the interesting thing about Peter Novick's book is that he talks about the Holocaust industry, but what he doesn't do is talk about Holocaust study at the universities. And there, we had a situation of polite denial of the Holocaust. Clark University established the chair that I now occupy. They established this chair in 1996. That chair, the Rose Professorship in Holocaust History, is the nation's first, let me underline that, first full-time, fully endowed chair in Holocaust history. Now, that's kind of amazing that it took 50 years for one single line in any history department in this entire country to be dedicated to study of the history of the Holocaust.
Did you set a precedent? Have other such chairs now been established?
Yes, and there's one right here in the Chicago area at Northwestern University. There is a chair in Holocaust studies, which is occupied by the eminent scholar Peter Hayes.
We know Peter. He's been on this program, of course. Let us go back to the phones, 591-7200. Hello, you're on the air.
A good program. I called with a comment, but just permit me to interpose a question which your question raised. It would be, how relevant is the Holocaust to the young German's national identity today? And then here's my comment to you. Milton, I have an assignment for you, if you would, regarding perhaps the intentionalist view of history, because you periodically have programs on the Holocaust. You're familiar with John Toland's two volumes on the biography of Hitler?
Not only am I familiar with it, I had him on the program when he wrote them.
Did you interview him regarding his autobiography entitled Captured by History in 1997?
Probably, I'm not sure.
All right. My assignment to you is take a look at that book, and at page 320, he discusses, and it's regarding Hitler's personal responsibility, that after Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote a second book, which he chose not to release, but it actually was published in 1961. And in it, he sets forth his two most important convictions, and one was seizing living space in the East and the total destruction of the Jews. See, before you have your next program on this, if you can find it, because this question's gone back and forth, and I was shocked to see Toland address it and the authority he brings to it.
Well, Toland's a curious character, as a matter of fact. He was personally rather anti-Semitic, as turned out from the reading of his memoir, at least. He was an odd fellow, and nor was he considered to be a very reliable scholar. He was a journalist who poked around. Do either of you know more about him?
No, I mean, what I know about him, what you tell now. I mean, I've read it. I mean, I grew up with his books back in Holland in the early 70s. I mean, that was what you read about Hitler. but in some way I haven't really followed his career anymore. But certainly Hitler's second book is an important one, because there in some way he sets out his plans for Europe, for how to acquire Lebensraum, which he has formulated as a policy in his first book. And indeed, it was only published in English for the first time in the 1960s by and edited by one of the prosecutors of the Nuremberg trial, Telford Taylor. But it's also interesting that in some way the Jews are not his central concern in that book. I mean, the central concern in that book is really how to get Germany back on its feet strategically, and the great mission of Germany in the East. So if it's difficult to use that book to actually talk about a consistent obsession of Hitler with the Jewish question.
He remains so painful a figure, and obviously so enigmatic a figure. Except I sometimes think Hitler represents the ultimate proof that a mediocre mind and neurotic tendencies can lead a man, if he reads a little and picks up a few ideas that he doesn't fully understand, reading in Darwin, reading in Wagner, reading in Haushofer, if he reads a little and is essentially not terribly bright but has tremendous narcissistic self-involvement and a kind of displaced and a falsely based enthusiasm for his own importance, he can do great, great harm.
Oh, unbelievable.
If people listen to him.
Absolutely.
And they listen to nuts of that sort. They listen to narcissistic, grandiose figures who are puffed up by the little bit of knowledge they've acquired and misinterpreted.
Especially if those people seem to be articulating their own innermost wishes and dreams and desires and promises that he will help them actualize those.
That's the nature of the so-called charismatic leader, I think.
I think you're
generally
absolutely
in history.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
What do you two, who are very significant historical scholars focused on the Holocaust, what do you think of the broader range of historical work on the Holocaust? Which writers have impressed you?
First of all, I think Raoul Hulberg. I mean, it's certainly, sometimes he's called the Pope of Holocaust history, and certainly it's not Pius XII. I mean, his work, The Destruction of the European Jews, is an absolute magnificent masterwork, and in some ways shaped the field very much when it was first published in the early 60s, and continues, I think, to have a very great influence on our thinking. So my first vote would go out to Raoul and his work.
And I think that my first vote would go to Nechama Tech. Nechama Tech, who is a survivor herself. She's also professor of sociology at the University of Connecticut. She's written a number of books about the Holocaust. And she focuses on areas that other people don't dare even touch. So a book that she will have coming out, and I hope that you'll have her here in the spring, will be on what happened to Jewish women during the Holocaust, because the Holocaust certainly targeted all Jews, but it doesn't mean that men and women experienced it differently, or that the road experienced it in the same way, or that the road to that death was the same.
Well, I hereby assert that a monumental contribution to Holocaust scholarship is the book now in hand. And at the same time, it's eminently readable for ordinary folk. My old friend Doug Greenberger used to run the Chicago Historical Society, I think speaks of this being done in luminous prose, and I think he's absolutely right. Holocaust, A History by Deborah Dwork and Robert Jan Van Pelt is available wherever they sell real books. Quick words about programs to come. Monday night, Alan Carlson of the Howard Center and Brian Robertson, both of them focused on what's happening to the American family. And Wednesday night, a very special program on the Lyric Opera of Chicago with two great international opera stars, Bryn Terfel and Jane Eglin, and as well as the director or the manager of the Lyric Opera of Chicago. And of course, a lot of wonderful music will be played on that night. Tuesday night, I didn't mention that, Ross Johnson returns, the wonderfully amusing and entertaining mentalist and magician. And with that, we come to the end of the available time for tonight. We look forward to being with you for a full week of programs next week. And until Monday at 9, thanks for listening and a cordial good night.